It's a bird.
It's a plane.
It's a magic marker. A felt pen.
It's a mistake.
It's a trap.
It's a fucking comedy.
It's quiet. Maybe too quiet.
It's all happening.
It's a good day to die.
It's a good day to talk about movies.
Welcome back. It is a good day to talk about everything, everywhere, all at once. I am your host, Duncan. Joining me on these Sunday Movie Squad episodes will be Kari.
Howdy.
And John.
Hey, what's up?
Glad to have you guys here. And like I said, for all of these Sunday Movie Squad episodes, this will be your hosting squad. We have me, Kari, and John, and we will present these episodes to you on the first Sunday of every month. This new monthly series will be kind of going with the flow for now. We're going with a new movie for this episode, but we're not sure what the topic of discussion will be going forward. We might try to nail down a specific theme for these episodes, but for the meantime, just enjoy what we have for you today. A quick reminder, on this podcast, we talk about movies we love and interview independent filmmakers. Every Friday, we have a full-length episode where we interview a independent filmmaker or have another guest on to talk about a movie they love. We also have bonus episodes releasing every Wednesday or Thursday. Those bonus episodes focus on a new TV show or movie or something relevant. In addition to those, we also have a new Monday miniseries releasing every Monday that, for now, will be focusing on nostalgia, Memories of Tomorrow, the new short film that me and Kari are both working on. If three episodes aren't enough for you, we, on top of that, have this, your Sunday Movie Squad episode, which, like I said, will be releasing the first Sunday of every month. This is the first one that we're ever releasing, so you're all caught up if you listen to this one, and you learn about everything, everywhere, all at once. Last Friday, we had a full episode where we interviewed Alex Lorien, the Australian independent filmmaker. And last Wednesday, we had a discussion of Severance Season 1, the new Apple TV Plus TV show, where we discussed all the events of Season 1. And last Monday, we also had the first Monday miniseries episode, where we delved into the beginnings of Nostalgia, Memories of Tomorrow. If you've missed those last episodes, check them out and get excited as well for all of our future episodes. Like I said, today we will be discussing Everything Everywhere All at Once in a spoiler-filled discussion. So that means this right now is your spoiler warning. If you have not seen Everything Everywhere All at Once or do not want it spoiled, stop listening now, go watch it, and get back to us later. For everyone else, that was your spoiler warning. So Everything Everywhere All at Once is a 2022 science fiction action film written and directed by Dan Kwan and Daniel Scheinert, collectively known as The Daniels. The film stars Michelle Yeoh, Stephanie Hugh, Kei Hu Kwan, Jenny Slate, Harry Shum Jr., James Hong, and Jamie Lee Curtis. I apologize if I mispronounced anyone's names there. I tried my best. The film is about a Chinese-American family who own a laundromat and are being audited by Jamie Lee Curtis. But if you've seen the movie, you know it goes crazy places from there, and it's obviously more of a multiverse movie. But that's the overall plot of the movie, and obviously it goes some crazy places from there. We'll get into that. But before we do that, let's get into our initial thoughts. Kari, we're going to start with you. We're going to get into our broad initial thoughts on Everything Everywhere All at Once, if you will.
Thanks, Duncan. I don't even know where to start, honestly. I guess I'll just dive into Everything Everywhere All at Once. But man, it's such a trip of a movie. It is like riding a roller coaster on acid, is how I describe the watching experience. I mean, it's quick cuts. It's fast paced. If you missed 5 minutes to run to the counter to get a bunch of crunch like I did, you can come back and be very confused with what's going on. So it really just keeps it going. I mean, it does a good job of not only in these type of movies balancing like a good comedic element with, you know, a lot of the callbacks that I love with, you know, Rakakui and the hot dog fingers, which I adored, with some deeper elements about, you know, the meaning of life, depression, even like nihilism that they really dove into, you know, represented by like this everything bagel kind of deity. So I thought it did a really good job of just balancing the serious topics with the comedic element underneath. Obviously, the editing was top notch. The fact that the entire movie features, you know, 60 characters made up of by six actors who all have to balance playing people from different dimensions is extremely impressive. So it has very lofty goals that it sets out to accomplish. And unlike a lot of movies that I see these days, it actually was able to accomplish most of them. So as close to a masterpiece as I've seen in recent years. And yeah, looks like to get into it. Very impressive.
Wow. Glowing review. Love to hear it. John, what did you think? What are your broad initial thoughts on Everything Everywhere All at Once?
Yeah, I mean, I have to echo what Kari said. I think it was just a mind-blowing experience, and it was just so imaginative and different from, you know, movies I've seen in recent years. I haven't been affected by a movie like that in a very long time. And I think, you know, beyond just the insane visuals and the crazy premise and, you know, all of that, I think the human element of the story is so, it just resonated with me so much. And I think it's very easy to put yourself in Evelyn's shoes, or really any of the characters, and just, you know, when she's kind of toying with the ideas of like what her life would look like if she had made different choices. I think we all do that all the time and wonder if we're living up to our potential, or, you know, what would have happened if we had gone a different route. So I think it's just, it's kind of rare for a movie like this in kind of like the science fiction realm to have that really relatable element, and that it's so easy for you to put yourself in the story and kind of get lost in those thoughts while you're watching. So I really enjoyed it. And yeah, I'm excited to dig in.
I also really enjoyed this movie. I think I might be a little bit lower than you guys, just because I think that masterpiece is a big word, Kari. And I don't know if I felt like it capitalized on everything maybe as well as I would have liked. But I think with all that being said, it's an amazing movie. I really did enjoy it. And the human elements there for sure, like you were saying, John, I definitely agree with that. But for me, I would say I was more into like the inventive filmmaking of it and the inventive fight choreography of it. Like that was the stuff that really got me going for it. It gets you going from the beginning with that fanny pack fight, the first real fight. I was just blown away by it. I was blown away by the choreography. They had like Western tie-ins. They had classic martial arts tie-ins where it was like very much referencing things. Like this movie is a Matrix movie in every other sense of the word other than the title, basically. You know what I mean? I saw it a second time with my father. I know we all saw it together, but I saw it a second time with my father, and he came out of it and was like, it's like the Matrix on acid. And I was like, that's exactly what it was. Yeah. And they've even, you know, alluded to them wanting to make their own, the Daniels, make their own Matrix movie. And I think they accomplished that. I think they did a really good job. I was set on this movie from the first trailer that I saw. And I think it would have been, I don't know what movie I would have been seeing. It might have been X, where I saw Everything Everywhere All at Once, because they like to show A24 trailers before A24 movies. They like to jam pack those in. So it might have been X. I'm not sure which movie I saw where I first saw the trailer for this, but I was like, oh yeah. And I'm not even someone who was like, knows Michelle Yeoh, or again, if I'm mispronouncing that, I apologize, but I'm not someone who was like inclined to already love it because of her. Whereas there's a lot of people who know her work, and I'm just, you know, that's a blind spot for me. I haven't seen a lot of older movies and more recent movies even, but I was just in from the beginning, and I think the cast does a great job. A lot of people are praising Michelle Yeoh's performance, but I think top to bottom, her husband was phenomenal. The daughter, phenomenal. I mean, Jamie Lee Curtis, we don't have to, you know, obviously she's going to be Jamie Lee Curtis and everything. She's going to be great. You don't even expect that. Same thing. I think people probably say that about people like Michelle Yeoh as well. I just don't know her work. So I don't want to like undercut her there and say like, oh, well, Jamie Lee Curtis is great and everything, where, you know, I'm sure all these actors are great and everything. She's the one actor I was aware of other than Jenny Slate going into this. But Jenny Slate obviously has a very minor role in this movie. Actually, not the only two actors I knew. There's also a very brief cameo from a I Think You Should Leave alum, Santa Claus. I don't know if anyone caught that. If you guys are I Think You Should Leave fans, season two, the guy who played Santa Claus was the guy in the laundromat who was like all over Evelyn.
I did not catch that.
Yeah. So just any listeners who maybe missed that, just go back, watch it. It's the guy who played Santa Claus in I Think You Should Leave season two, which I Think You Should Leave is just hit, no misses. So those are my long-winded broad thoughts, but let's get into the actual discussion, no?
Yeah.
Let's do it.
Hell yeah, let's do it. So the movie obviously starts off with the family getting ready for Chinese New Year at their laundromat slash apartment, which is above the laundromat. And Evelyn, the main character, is running around all over the place, very busy, which is like a line from the trailer and the movie that never fails to get laughs. You know, very busy today. Great line. But anyways, you can see that. They show you that before she says it, that she is running all over the place. She's got a million things on her mind. But they also show you, for example, the daughter and the daughter's girlfriend and how that's treated. Not only with the grandfather, but even in her showing up and then being like, oh, now I have to make more food. I didn't make enough food for everyone. Very much dismissive of this girlfriend in all aspects, not even in the aspect of it being like, oh, how do I explain this to my father, her grandfather, that she's dating a girl, which in 2022 shouldn't be an issue anymore. But obviously there's people who have that are hung up on that, especially older folks who are hung up on that and like older generations where that maybe wasn't necessarily the normal thing then, which is not to say that it should be looked down upon in today, but it is to say that like you have to understand where the grandpa's coming from, I think. You know, like I'm not saying that the grandpa's like a bad character from the beginning. I'm just saying that, you know, he's unresponsive to that type of thing at the beginning of the movie, at least. And that's what Evelyn is thinking too, is that she doesn't want to have to deal with explaining that to him. And that's the situation she's in. And she's not really thinking about her daughter at all there. And that's a big key part of the movie. But so from there, we get them going to the IRS agency and Jamie Lee Curtis, who plays the IRS agent, talking about all the issues. And here we get very thematic things where it's like the husband saying, my wife confuses her hobbies with her work. And she's like, well, according to this, you're a teacher, a cook, a dance artist, a this, that, the other. And she's listing off all these jobs. And of course, if you know where this movie's going, you're like, yeah, motherfucker, she is. Yeah, she is. Right. And so we get that. And then the inciting incident is on the elevator up to the IRS agency. We get the husband from a different universe coming in and talking to her. And then we get then when she's talking to Jamie Lee Curtis, she decides to, all right, let me try what he told me to do. And she gets pulled back into the closet and talks to him. And he explains to her what's going on. And this is the explanation in these two scenes in the elevator and in the closet for the audience as well. And I think they do a really good job of explaining to her and us at the same time. That's how you do exposition well. So up to here, I'd love to hear you guys' thoughts on it. We obviously haven't gotten into the action yet, but what do you guys think of the opening setup of the movie and where we're led to go from there?
Good exposition. It really, like Duncan mentioned, does a good job of setting the scene of what to expect for the rest of the movie and in a little amount of time too. So, you know, it wasn't like over maybe like 20, 25 minutes or so before we get into the first fight scene. So it doesn't spend too much time lingering in the exposition, which is good. Jamie Lee Curtis, as soon as her character comes in, she's putting up 30 points and 13 rebounds off the bench in limited minutes. She's just killing it. And yeah, I guess we'll talk about that a little bit now, but the first fight scene with the fanny pack was just really well done. It's not that tough to do a fight scene, but you often, I don't see it that well, very well choreographed, which I thought this was, and some of the others. So it jumps kind of right into it on a high note. So I thought the first like 30 minutes was pretty well executed.
Yeah, I'd have to agree with you both. I think the setup is great. And, you know, it does a good job of showing what's troubling each character, I think, from the jump. You've got Evelyn, who's sort of like daydreaming about the what ifs of her life and also trying to, you know, live up to her father's really tough standards. Like she mentions the way the noodles are cooked, you know, like, don't let them get overcooked. He hates it that way. You've got, you know, her husband who's trying to find the right time to bring up the divorce and like break through to her because there's been this disconnect. The daughter, you know, similarly feeling the disappointment of her parents and trying to, you know, get acceptance. It's just, yeah, I think you can kind of tell where things are headed from there. And it's a great setup. And I think just Jamie Lee Curtis, like you said, is such a scene stealer. Like, we've all dealt with somebody like that in an office setting or customer service setting. And I think just like the wrist brace that she had on and like the way she feverishly is like brushing the cookie crumbs off her shirt and has like the butt plug trophies behind her from the office is so funny. But yeah, no, I'm excited to feel a little deeper now.
One thing that just came to mind, I know Waymond, like, all right, he's trying to find the right time to serve the divorce papers. Is this really the right time with the dad in town, like Chinese New Year? You couldn't have waited like 5 days. I guess that makes sense for the plot, but now that I think about it, like, come on, there's a lot going on, man.
That's a good point.
But I think because it sounds like, I don't know if I'm understanding this right, but he doesn't really mean it. He just wanted to finally get her attention for real. So, but still, yeah, the timing is a bit.
Yeah, that's a really good point. That in the one scene where she accidentally goes to a very close universe, right, where she's in the car right after the IRS agency and they're discussing the divorce papers, he says, like, I think it was his friend or his brother or someone, they talked about divorce and it really helped them through it. And that's clearly where his thought process is. Like, he doesn't want a divorce, I don't think. He wants to push her into caring about stuff, right? And I think that's the important part there, is I don't think that, I think it's important to note that he doesn't necessarily actually want a divorce. Like you were saying, John, I think he's trying to push her in the right direction. And John, you were mentioning the comedy in this, which we hadn't touched on. I meant to mention in my opening thoughts, out there comedy, not just like comedy, but they're taking big swings as well. And they worked for me. Like, we'll talk about Raccoon and we'll talk about the hot dog fingers. They worked for me, but they didn't just drop them in there. They lingered on them.
Oh, yeah.
Like, Raccoon comes up 5 different times. The hot dog fingers come up 5 different times. They keep coming back to them. They're not just dropping them in on you. So I actually appreciated that they were willing to take these big swings. And if they don't work for you, they're going to be big misses. You know what I mean? Like, if that hot dog finger thing doesn't work for you, that's going to be a weird part of the movie, right? And for me, it did work. And it sounds like for you guys, it worked on the comedic level as well. Those type of things, like the butt plugs is a great example as well. Later on, it's like they have to shove them up their asses, actually. It's like they're like very explicit about it. They're like, no, we know what the joke is here. And I think they're good at that, you know, balancing the humor and the great action, as well as the sci-fi elements and the family human aspect of it as well, which is like really interesting to see a balance like that done. You know what I mean?
Yeah. One thing on the butt plugs, I was reading about just a little bit of background. Apparently that wasn't like just something they threw in that they thought was funny. Like that's how the movie idea originated. Was, I think Dan Kwan was thinking about the movie and he was trying to come up with like a sci-fi movie. And he was like, what if you could like shove something up your butt and like jump to a different dimension? And that's kind of how the whole thing spiraled. So just interesting to know that that's where this all came from. But yeah, I thought you'd have more pain if you jumped and landed onto a butt plug like that, wouldn't you? But I guess that's, you overlook that. But yeah, the comedy stuff kind of landed.
I take my accounting award and I shove it up my ass. So yeah, we get here the action sequence, the first action sequence, which is the fanny pack fight, which we were talking afterwards about it being very like reminiscent of Jackie Chan fights, which is very like American's first martial arts movie thing to say, I feel like. But it was, in the sense that like they use in Jackie Chan movies, they use like things like, there's that classic scene of him fighting with a ladder, right? And he's using the things around him. And that's what's happening in this scene, I feel like, where you have Wayman using the fanny pack he's got on, like, and like even down to the pulling the fish tank rocks out and putting it in there and then just whopping that guy across the cubicle. Beautiful. And we talked about the camera work in it. I think that you have some really inventive camera work throughout it. And the one that really stuck out to me was when the gun's on the ground and they're reaching for the gun and it gets moved to the side and the camera is like gun level on the ground, And when it gets moved to the side, the camera moves with it. And it's beautiful. I don't know if you guys know the shot I'm talking about, but it's just, I think the entire fight is very well shot. And it got me going from the beginning. You know what I mean? And obviously from here, we get more of the reveal of who the bad guy is, right? We find out that it's the daughter. It's Waymon and Evelyn's daughter, Joy, or Jobu Tepaki. I think I'm saying that right. Jobu Tepaki? Maybe. Evelyn can't even say it.
Yeah, I tried to look up what that means. I don't know if we have had that throw in anywhere, but apparently it was originally written for Jackie Chan. So maybe that's why some of the like fight scenes resemble some of the stuff he's done before.
That makes sense that it was originally written for Jackie Chan, I guess, because I can see it, honestly. But they did well with Adam, honestly. I'm not to say that Jackie Chan's not a great screen presence and he would have been great in it, but I don't want to take anything away from any of the actors that are in this movie because I think they all did great with their parts and great on that emotional level too. John, like again, like you mentioned earlier, where Waymon, for example, is like hitting those emotional beats, but then also being a fucking badass. And same thing with Michelle Yeoh as Evelyn, dude. You know what I mean? Like just hitting these emotional beats and being... Like, I've gone back now and watched some of her old stuff. She is a martial arts badass. By, you know, like, should be in the same talks as Jackie Chan is, honestly, in my opinion. Like,
I didn't know that either going into it, that she had such an extensive, like, karate background, which isn't even evident, I don't think, when you watch it. It looks like just the stunt person doing a great job. I don't know how much of it was her doing her own stunts, but... she's very accomplished. I think that was, they wrote the part about her having a life as the karate thing. I think that was kind of like a wink and a nod to like Michelle Yeoh's past doing that. So, and apparently they were thinking about naming the character Michelle too, but she didn't want to have it. She wanted to tell like a different story, have it be unique to the character versus like having it be too much tied to her personal background. So they strayed a little bit, but left some of those parts in that were unique to her. So I think it's good in general when you have a link between like experiences that the character has and experiences that the actor or actress playing them has had as well. I feel like it always ties a little something extra to the performance. So I thought that was a good touch.
I don't know if you guys saw any of the press that the actors did, but I saw this interview that Michelle Yeoh did, and like she said, this project was excited her more than anything she'd done in the past. And she thought, you know, finally, I'm given a role that shows I can be sad, I can be happy, I can be the action star, I can be all of these things in one. And I think that was just really evident in the performance too. But I just thought it was an interesting note, you know, how excited she was about the project and that she felt like it showed kind of her full range in the role. And I think it did. I mean, yeah, she really got to hit on everything. Yeah, just was really interesting.
So from here, we get into more of the meat of the story. We get Evelyn proving herself as being the Evelyn, right? And we also get that funny line where the Waymon who's in the know is like, you're so bad at everything you do. That's what makes you who I need. Like, you never accomplished anything. You started everything and never finished it. And he calls her the worst version of herself, which is kind of a dick thing to say, but it's funny. I definitely got a laugh both times I watched it from the audience, but we get her proving herself because he abandons her. He's like, you're not the right Evelyn. I'm sorry. I gotta go. I gotta leave you, and just leaves her to get fucked basically. And then she messes up Jamie Lee Curtis in that when she's flying down the flight of stairs to kick her in the face. And she kind of at the last second goes into the martial arts version of Evelyn and is able to fuck her up. And then that's when Wayman's back and it's like, all right, fine. Like, you're here for me when I'm good, but you're not here for me when I'm bad. I was like, fuck you, other Wayman. But then we get the other Wayman and the other grandpa both trying to, I should call them Alpha. Alpha Wayman and Alpha Grandma trying to get Evelyn to kill her version of Joy, kill her own daughter. And here is where we get the real crux of the movie, where Evelyn's like, no, we can fix this. And the Alpha people are like, well, if you're not going to kill her, then you're now our enemy. And we definitely can't have two of you running around. If you're going to be this crazy version of Evelyn. We can't have two of you running around. So now we have the conflict between the alphas, and they become the actual bad guys of it, and Evelyn, right? And now Joy, the bad version, Jobu Tupaki, is not the actual villain of the movie anymore, but the ideas behind her are the villain of it, I think. And trying to prove to her that those ideas are not right and that we can salvage this is Evelyn's goal of the movie, right? And it's not to do what the alpha people want her to do. It's not to kill the Joys and get rid of Jobu Tupaki. It's to fix the situation, right? It's to apologize. It's to say, I'm sorry. It's to amend what you've done in the past. And I think that's a big sticking point in this movie. I think it's really interesting where it goes from there, where at this almost midpoint of the movie, we get that revelation where it's like, Evelyn's not gonna just do what the alphas want her to do.
Yeah. It kind of follows a similar arc as a lot of movies with the Chosen One, where they're identified, and then it's that point in where it's like, oh, you're not the Chosen One anymore. And they prove themselves, and there's that moment where it's like, oh, this is the person. So it does follow that similar arc, but I love it every time. But honestly, Duncan, something you said had me thinking, like, what versions of yourself are there if you had had the same thing as, Evelyn, where like every, path that you gave up on is somewhere existing in a different universe. It's definitely some food for thought, but that's a tangent we don't have to go down. I like how they transition from Joy, the daughter, being the villain to kind of Evelyn, being brought in to her side in a way. And they really dive into some deep and dark content in this area where the daughter is, I guess this is a little later in the movie, but once her and Evelyn spend more time together, she gets into those, I've seen everything and therefore like everything is meaningless. And they kind of dive down that hole, which is, an interesting subject matter for a film. And not entirely where I saw this going at the beginning with the dark kind of topic about like nothing being worth it, but obviously they do a good job, I think, at the end, bringing it back to that. But yeah, I think it was good to transition in the middle and you get some really good content out of her jumping to the different multiverses with the hot dogs and the rock. I love how they included the scene where they see with the gorillas, like the hot dog versus the opposable thumbs. Which, how could wouldn't the opposable thumbs gorillas be like -500 in that one-on-one battle with the ability to grip things? Like you have rocks and sticks, like how would you lose that fight one-on-one? It wasn't even like a game fight to the hot dog gorilla, but whatever. So there's some good stuff in there as they're jumping around. So yeah, it was a good transition, and it does a good job of, introducing the everything bagel kind of at this point. And, her mentioning that, she wanted to put everything on a bagel, including like Craigslist posts and like salt, no ketchup. And I think, I'm not sure what the everything bagel was supposed to represent. I guess just like the meaning of life. I don't know. That one went over my head, but I don't know if anyone else had thought
about. I thought it was just like a singularity, like a black hole, pretty much. Like it's just like putting so much onto one thing that it collapses in on itself.
I guess that's true.
It's kind of like an existential threat that she created.
That's true. Black hole is probably a better way to represent it.
And I think that we have to mention that, showing the gorillas, that's another reference as well, to 2001: A Space Odyssey. So we have to give them their dues for doing that. That's a iconic scene from 2001: A Space Odyssey that they're redoing with hot dog fingers. So great stuff there, I think. But I do understand, they got to be, 500? Dude, I'm thinking like 10,000.
Yeah, at least. I was going to say 3-on-1, maybe the hot dog fingers will win, but 1-on-1. Like you can't even really throw a punch.
Dude, the Bucks were -800 last night. You're telling me the Bucks had a better chance than the fucking gorillas with hands? No way.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know how that worked out, but
anyway.
Can we talk about Joy's kind of, or I guess it's not Alpha Joy, but the Joy who's the master of verse jumping, her kind of intro in the movie? Like how sick was that scene where she comes out of the elevator with the pig on a leash and like so many outfit changes. The physical comedy was so funny. Like, I think back to when she's walking under the police tape into the building and basically does like limbo under it and is just like laughing to herself the whole time. And you see in like the previous scene when she's in the alternate universe killing off one of the other Evelyns, she does like this gesture where she's like flicking her fingers with like her head to like quickly shuffle through different universes. I thought that was so cool. They just really show you her mastery of like first jumping and all the crazy skills right off the bat. And like, it's just so imaginative. And I think it's a good way to set up like what is possible in this, you know, universe they've created. And then like, we see Evelyn's, you know, growth into that. Like when she comes out of the, that back room of the office and like suddenly knows how to do all those things too. The dungeon room I'm talking about, when she comes out and she's able to do it the same way without, you know, earpieces and just kind of is like a master. I just thought it was cool that the way they set it up and how much fun she's having with it, like the fake blood and the weird voices, and she's just like messing with everybody. It was so fun to watch that.
It was super impressive. The head turn at one point where he like I can't even really do it justice, but the whole scene there, she like turns the baton into a dildo, and the ketchup that, or the tomato sauce that's like organic, was great way to introduce the villain. And yeah, to your point, John, just show like her repertoire of multiverse moves.
And it shows that she's like this twisted character because of what Evelyn's done to her, because of what Alpha Evelyn did to that version of her. I think it is Alpha Joy. I could be wrong, but I think it was Alpha Joy, because Alpha Evelyn pushed her to that point that would kill people, but turned her into the verse jumping Joy. And so that was my understanding, at least, that it was, again, it's what the mom did to the child was pushing on them. And that's like a big theme of the movie, right? And people have noted that it's like a big theme of multiple movies, actually, in 2022 and 2021. Encanto being another one, where it's like parents wanting to apologize to kids or needing to apologize to their children about things. And I think it's beautiful, honestly. I think that what they did with this movie was really smart in, again, back to what you said, John, like the people, the human aspect of it, the character development and where they go with that. Because if this movie is just visually stunning, which it is, it doesn't do enough. I don't think. Like, it doesn't get this response that we're giving it and that audiences around the world have given it already. You know, it's not just the three of us saying that we like this movie. It's plenty of people. There's a reason that it's went from 20 movies theaters in US to nationwide, like, very quickly. It got an expanded release because of that kind of stuff. But if you just have like Matrix-esque stuff and Jackie Chan-esque stuff and references that are funny, but just funny, to Ratatouille and 2001 and other movies as well. But if you only have those things and you don't have this human element, this real personal connection that you can get, does this movie hit as hard? I absolutely don't think so. You know what I mean? And I think we can get into like some of the later parts of it, but I do want to just touch on, like, again, the human aspects of it. And I think we want to probably touch on the human aspects of it as they relate to the third act, probably. And we can get into that now. But if we want anything else in the middle part of it, like where we're talking about, I think the rocks come up for the first time in the middle part, for example. And then they're really paid off in the third act, right? But we have other things that come up in the second act. And if you guys want to touch on any of those before I move on to the third act, I want to give you the chance to do that now. I do want to also mention that we have, obviously, it begins with everything is the title card, right, at the beginning. And then we get everywhere. And then we get all at once. And everywhere and all at once are very much the last act of the movie. Because all at once is like 5 minutes. And everywhere is the tie up of the movie. Is the real wrap up of the movie.
The rocks are like the one aspect I didn't love, but only because I think, well, one, I thought it was really funny, but two, they gave some significant content to the rock scenes. where they're like sitting there and suddenly they're talking about, or she's like, well, you know, I actually really wanted to bring you along on this journey with me to see if you could show me something that I didn't see myself, like some really deep content that they gave to the Rocks, which is like one that would have been a much more powerful scene, I think, if Michelle and, or not Michelle, I guess Evelyn's the character, Evelyn and Joy are talking about that face to face. Like that's kind of the crux of the whole jumping, and it's just like typed out on screen. So I didn't love that. And two, it's just kind of lazy, I thought, that instead of having that emotion be showed via acting, suddenly it's Rocks and someone's typing. So I was like, oh, they're just force feeding us the content here, which is fine. But I thought that was one of the few aspects of the movie I didn't like, was like that the Rocks should be used for comedic effect, but for this like emotional crescendo, I really thought it should have been like the two actors in person.
One thing that I just thought of when you were mentioning that, because I think it's true, you do kind of wonder why that medium was used at that point in the story. But I think something to consider is like they didn't really have that open dialogue at that point in the story yet. Like when they come, it all finally boils over when Joy, you know, leaves the laundromat after the big, you know, blowout at the party, and you know, she leaves and they finally have the face-to-face and the heart-to-heart they've been, you know, needing to have for so long. Before that, I mean, I guess maybe they were most comfortable starting to talk to each other in the Rock universe because it's more approachable that way. I don't know. Maybe that's why they did that. I was just trying to think of, you know, what the reason could be. But yeah, because I think it really, that point when it all just boils over at the laundromat was really powerful. So I like that they waited until then to do it.
Yeah, oh, that's a good point. I mean, I didn't think about that, but that's a good, I hope it was intentional then that they did that and, you know, include that scene, because it's tough to connect sometimes face to face, and sometimes it's easier when there's that, you know, barrier between you, whether it's you know, text messages or a different room, or you know, when one of you is sedimentary and one of you is igneous, and you know, so it's that's a good point there, John. Yeah, so hopefully that was intentional. The Rocks were definitely funny. How could they move as Rocks? I guess that doesn't matter.
Yeah, I mean, they wouldn't be able to move for sure. But I will say though that now that you've mentioned it, Kari, it almost does feel like an ease thing that they might have done. Right, where it was like an ease of filming type situation, where I'm not dismissing what you said at all, John, where it's like I like what you, where you're coming from it, and I'm gonna prefer to come at it from that angle. But I do see that gripe where you're saying, Kari, where it's like almost like, was it easier to just do it this way? You know what I mean?
Yeah, it seemed like a cop out.
I will say that a lot of those scenes, both the comedic version of it and then the more deep version of it, seemed to connect with the audiences that I was watching it with. So maybe, you know, that lends to John's point where it was like, maybe it worked, right?
Yeah.
Also something to consider, like, I don't know if you guys, how you thought about it, but it felt like Evelyn didn't share the same sense of like dread and disappointment once she saw everything the way that Joy did. So I don't know if she would have been able to relate as much, you know, to what was being said when they were in that Rock universe. Like I thought you would see something different, but it seemed like she kind of maintained more positivity about things. I'm having trouble remembering now, like, what her response was to that line about, I showed you the bagel, you know, so that maybe you could help me figure out how to get out of it, whatever. But do you guys remember how she responded?
One thing to also point out is that they were fighting during this like portion of the movie. So the Rock is like the first time that they couldn't fight and they were forced to just sit there and talk to each other. So it might have been that.
I don't know what they said there, unfortunately. So going off everything we've said so far, I think we're going to jump into the third act of the movie now, if that's all right with you guys.
Let's do it.
All right. So in this final act of the movie, we have Everywhere and All at Once, but we also have Joy coming with her minions, and we have Evelyn on the steps, right? We have this in the main level of the IRS building. We have Joy at the top of the steps with the everything bagels that she's brought here. And we have Evelyn trying to stop Joy from going into that bagel and becoming nothing, basically. That's the idea of it, right? And here is where we also get Evelyn as a movie star, which I think is a very important other Evelyn, talking to Waymond, who this is the version of her who didn't run off with Waymond, right? And who listened to her father when he gave her that ultimatum. And we see in this life that she's yearning for Waymond, which is beautiful. It's great thematically. It's great for you as a viewer to watch it. I got goosebumps watching them like walk up to each other and her being like, you? And him being like, you know, I thought I'd stop by. And then that conversation after the movie, when they're, you know, he's smoking the cigarette and they're outside, I think it's raining, and she's trying to say like, this is what our life would have been if we had been together. You know, we would have been accountant, you know, we would have been audited by the IRS as we're owning a laundromat. And he has that beautiful line closer to the end where he's like, you know, in another life, I'd love to have just been owning a laundromat with you, struggling, you know? And I love all of that. And I really like this version of Evelyn and this realization that she gets in this version of Evelyn, right? And I also like that it cuts with her death to the end of the movie, where I was looking around like, who's going to be the asshole that stands up right now? Because I was like, I know how long this movie is. We are not at the end right now, right? So I was like kind of looking around the audience to be like, who thinks it right now? You got fooled. And I love how it cuts to her watching that movie and the audience like clapping and everything. You know what I mean? And it's as if everything, I should stop right there, just everything, because that's all we've seen so far, is the movie that she's premiering in the universe where she is the movie star. They're all watching that movie, or we're watching them watch that movie, whatever you want to eat. This movie has weeds that you can get into the weeds of. So, you know, whenever you do a Matrix type movie, you get into the weeds. So here we are in the weeds, and I like they did this, and I like, again, that emotional connection. I'm going to keep coming back to that first thing you said, John, that emotional connection, that human connection that we get with the two of them talking there. And it's Evelyn being very honest, right?
Yeah, no, I'm so happy you brought that up too, because I think for so much of the movie, we see Evelyn resenting Waymond, and when she's exposed to the other possibilities for what her life could have been, she resents him even more. But we find out in this universe that them being apart, they actually were both very successful. She was like, oh, you went to America, you should be, you know, why aren't you, I forget what she said, but like basically, why aren't you poor? And he's like, hey, I guess I got lucky. Like, they both potentially could be holding each other back. And it's interesting, in one of the universes where they don't end up married, they're both, you know, wildly successful. But it's funny, like, she shifts all the blame onto him for a lot of the movie, but actually she might, you know, be holding him back. And in the real universe, you know, he's the one to present the divorce paperwork, and it's, you kind of wonder how she's holding him back, or like suppressing qualities of his that make him, you know, special in their main universe, and why he was able to flourish, you know, without her in the movie star universe. So I just thought that was interesting.
Yeah. I wonder why they weren't able to succeed together, what that says about them as a couple. I definitely thought that was interesting too. One of the more powerful scenes when they're talking, and, you know, yeah, he's like, oh, I just got lucky. And I think she like tries to go for it, and he like, you know, rejects her, which is interesting as well. But yeah, I mean, I think, and one thing that you mentioned earlier, Duncan, is that the whole theater seemed to react to the scene where it's like the Rock's just talking. And I think part of that is because the like underlying message, or one of the many that this movie, I think, is trying to convey about the difficulty in connecting across generations, like the Gong Gong to Evelyn and then Evelyn to Joy, is something that, you know, a lot of people can relate to, whether it's up or down or both. And to your point, it's been a constant theme in a lot of the media that's been released now, is like that difficulty that people are having, either, you know, the previous generation connecting with the youth these days or the opposite way around. So I think when they touch on some of that messaging around, you know, the sexuality component, there is like the life decisions component, just a lot of the ways that both Gong Gong, Evelyn's father didn't connect with her, and that she is unable to connect with her child, I think a lot of people can relate to. So I think it's definitely a powerful message that resonates. I think it was delivered well. So yeah, I think the middle where the crux hits and, you know, Rakakuni gets carried away and everything goes on, definitely a pivotal spot.
I think Kari made a great point about, you know, connecting across generations and kind of how sometimes parenting mistakes can get passed down from generation to generation. And it was really interesting in the third act when Evelyn, you know, kind of flips the script and is like setting an example for Joy almost when she stands up to Gong Gong in the laundromat and says, you know, I don't care if you're proud of me because I finally am. And that was after, you know, she had been exposed to all the different, you know, possibilities, all the different paths her life could have taken. And this is in, you know, her home universe where she's just, her life is messy and simple, but she loves it. And I think that's something she learns from Waymond in that movie star universe is, you know, in another life, I would have loved just doing laundry and taxes with you. Like, it, you know, nothing is promised. And I think the life that you have, you know, how messy or simple it might be, like, is something to be cherished. And I think like that light bulb moment where she's able to see that and be proud of what she has instead of that longing, you know, for the other lives where she's famous and successful is really powerful.
Yeah, I totally agree. And that's actually a point that I wanted to make going off of what you were saying, Kari, was that it's not necessarily that they could have been so much better, both her and Wayman, without being together. I don't think it's that. It's that, hey, owning a laundromat is just as good as being this movie star, being this successful businessman that Wayman is. I think it's the point is that if you went that route, you know what you don't have? Joy. And I, you know, as I say that, it sounds very literal that her name is Joy. You know, it sounds almost not even an accident that her name is Joy, but you don't get Joy then. You don't have Joy. And I think that's a point that's made throughout the film is that you wouldn't give up anything for your daughter, right? And you wouldn't give up this life that you have that maybe is stressful, and it's not perfect. Nothing's perfect, right? Owning a laundromat, getting audited by the IRS, none of that is perfect, but it's your life, right? And it's something that I brought back on this podcast before, where it's like, I like to bring it back to my college experience, where it's like, everyone I think ends up at the right place, because I know I did, because I wouldn't have met you, Kari, I wouldn't have met you, John, had I not been at UNC. Same thing with Gardner and all of our friends. You know what I mean? This podcast wouldn't exist without UNC. So I always like to bring it back to college, where it's like, I think you end up at the right place for better or worse. And for better or worse, it feels like Wayman and Evelyn ended up in the right place, right? Because otherwise they wouldn't have Joy. She wouldn't exist. And sure, maybe we wouldn't have this universe breaking evil villain, but the point of the movie is she's not evil, right? She's a person who was put through some shit and who is trying to deal with that.
That's one thing I want to touch on quickly. We're going to get a little hypothetical. So obviously in the version where she knows that Raymond, or, you know, a life exists with Waymond and Joy, she goes back to like the movie theater, movie star version, and she's unsatisfied. At least because she grew up in one life and now in another, she's missing it. I feel like there's an angle you could make an argument too, where if the Evelyn at the end is, you know, the one who is the movie star, and then she's introduced to the other universes and she jumps to them all and she goes to, you know, see where she's married to Wayman and she's to give up this big successful career, if she wouldn't look back on it as well and say like, oh man, like this other universe looks good, but the universe I have in mind is, you know, I'd still want to return to that. So I think there's an element that at least you can look at it from that perspective as well. I mean, it still, I think, goes to your argument, Duncan, that everyone ends up in the right place, but the fact that she wants to be originally like in her home universe. I think that argument might hold true as well, even if she was coming from those other universes. The point I'm trying to make is that I don't think one of the universes inherently is more valuable than the others.
No, but I agree with you. I think what you're saying actually works to my point, at least in my interpretation of it, because I think the point is that Evelyn made that choice. And it was the right choice for that Evelyn. And our Evelyn made the choice to stay with Wayman. And that was the right choice for her. And so I think you're 100% right. I think any version of Evelyn you get should, at least in my interpretation of the movie, want what they have. Whether or not they start with having Joy and being with Wayman or not, the message should be not that this is the one life that was right for you. It was whichever life you end up in. So whichever version of you ends up in that life, that's the right life for that version of you. That's my idea of it. And it might be a very like Disney, everything's always happy way to look at it. But I do think that's part of the message of the movie, that maybe right for our Evelyn, this is her universe. But that's because, like you said, Kari, this literally is her universe, right? Like, not only is this the right universe for her, but it's the one that she exists in. And because she exists in it, it is the right universe for her. At least that's how I look at it.
Yeah, I mean, I think the idea is there's something to be desired in every universe. And, you know, maybe the one that we start in isn't as glamorous as others. It's something that Evelyn chose. She knew, you know, leaving her home country and coming to America would be hard. And, you know, it wouldn't be glamorous and it'd be tough to build something from nothing. But, you know, there's something beautiful in that too, like compared to the more glamorous possibilities that, you know, could have happened for her. But
it's easy to show like, all right, here you are, Evelyn, like married and poor, or you are super famous and rich and you're single. What if she jumped to a universe where she still has Joy, but it's like, yeah, you know, you're a, you know, a mildly successful lawyer, you're not super famous but you have money. I feel like Evelyn would be a little bit more like, I don't know, maybe I would jump. Like they show the extreme, so it's easy for her to be like, I want my daughter. But somewhere in the middle, like you still have the daughter and you know you're like a, you know, you own a chain of successful like Chick-fil-A restaurants. She's probably like, you know what? That's not bad. You know, I'm saying, why not give her some tougher options to make the decision from?
But yeah. I think you kind of have like a Wizard of Oz effect of like, I just want to go home by the end of it. Like you've seen all these cool things, but it's like, this is crazy. Let me just get back to what I know. Like, and then you learn to appreciate what you had. Like, I think when one scene that stuck with me was in the laundromat scene where she ends up smashing the window and the police come and everything, how she says, you know, what did, so Wayman gets the cops to leave and they end up getting another week to prepare their documents. She turns to Jamie Lee Curtis's character and says, what did my silly husband say to you to make this happen? And she was like, you know, he was just like real with me and told me about your situation. And, you know, I've been through the same thing, blah, blah, blah. So like she kind of starts to appreciate women's superpower of like being kind and how, you know, special that is in her home universe. Like the little things he used to do, he put like the googly eyes on the bags of laundry and just like little, you know, positive things he would sprinkle throughout their life together. So I think, you know, well, like she definitely, we watch her like fight the temptation from the other universes throughout the movie. I think that journey definitely makes her appreciate what she had a lot more.
Yeah, it's a little bit of like the Rudolph thing there, that she didn't really like him until she realized that he could do something for her. But nonetheless, I thought it was a good message. Now that we're talking about the end of the movie, so 1 week later, they're still like nearing foreclosure. Are they going to come up with the money? I don't understand how the situation changes.
Is it a money situation or is it a like, let's figure out the...
They're like committing tax fraud. They're trying to write off all these expenses that...
No, but I know, I do know that you can have someone figure that out. like committing, like you don't have to always pay the exact amount and everything. Like you can definitely work that out. There are like, just as someone who's worked with like accounting and stuff like that, I do know that there are like ways around certain things. So it's not like they're completely fucked.
Yeah, I'm sure they can avoid it a little bit, but they should have tied like a little financial dot at the end where it's like, oh, like it seems like they're still like, yeah, they're gonna wake up the next morning. She's like, fuck, all right, we gotta give her, I think 2 weeks after the movie ends, she's gonna be like, man, can I jump to like the movie theater or the movie star world just for like a few minutes? But yeah, I thought the way they wrapped it up was good. It was heartwarming. The conversation that like Joy and Evelyn have at the end, I forget what she says, but
wasn't it like, why do you want to be here with me? Like, I'm such a disappointment. The daughter is saying like, you could be in a universe where I'm, you know, more than this type of thing. I don't know if that helps, but
yeah, I think it was. And just the like, I don't know, it was a little cheesy, but it definitely worked. Like they're like, oh, you know, I wouldn't want to be anywhere but with you or something. However she ended it. So it was, I thought they wrapped a lot of the storylines that they had up pretty well.
I do agree. I see that you have a little bit of a pessimistic view on the ending, or the ending note at least, on if we're gonna, everything's gonna be all right, or if we love everything in this. I do feel like you were a little more positive at the beginning on your opening thoughts than you have been on your discussion throughout it, Kari, I have to say.
I still think it's a really good movie, but I feel like a lot of these movies, or maybe I'm just pessimistic about these situations in general, but there's a lot of movies where it's like, you know, Die Hard, like they got problems with my wife, and then you kill all the bad guys and your wife kisses you. It's like, all right, great. 3 months later, when she's like bitching at you to take out the trash, problems are right back. Like, I feel like they never, I guess they do show that, because in Die Hard 2, they get divorced, but I feel like those things where it's like right after the stressful situation, yeah, you feel great. And then like 2 weeks later, they're right back into like, fuck, Wayman, he messes up the laundry again. She's going to be like, ah, fuck, like, I want to jump a little bit.
No, but she learned a lesson, right? Like, she's got to have learned a lesson.
It's been like one day, the lesson. I mean, my whole point is that, like, all right, give it like 6 months and then we'll see if she's the same point. I don't think this affects the movie. This is just my pessimistic outlook.
All right. So now that we've gotten to the pessimism of it and we've gotten through most of the ending, do we have any notes that we want on the final aspects of the film? I know we've kind of touched on everything. I feel like we did bring up the most aspects of the ending, but if you guys have anything, now would be the time before we get into our final thoughts.
Yeah, I have a few just like random tidbits. The guy who plays Wayman was Short Round also in like Indiana Jones 2, which I did not realize, who obviously killed it. You don't really see like child actors a lot grow up to be really talented adult actors. And then James Wong, who is the Gong Gong, is 93. Like, holy crap. He did a good job. Like, he's standing up and everything throughout the movie. I don't know. I would not have put him at 93. I would have given him like late 70s maybe. So super, like, impressive performance from someone who's like 5 years younger than like Betty White. Or I don't know, who's a really old person now that she passed away. But so that stood out to me as well. You actually can see the raccoon in the first time that she jumps to the like the chef universe, like hanging out with the back of the hat, which I only caught on the second time through. So I thought that was a nice touch.
Yeah, second view, you can totally see his tail.
Yeah, I did not catch it the first time, but it definitely sticks out the second time.
As they're talking about how good of a chef he is.
Yeah.
It's like very much, it's like the breadcrumbs are so there.
One thing before I forget, the music throughout was so, just this, the way it was, the way the score was done, I thought was really effective. And Kari mentioned callbacks earlier, like Claire de Lune being like a running theme throughout the movie, and those like slow-mo moments I thought was so cool. And then in the Hot Dog Fingers universe, when Jamie Lee Curtis is playing Claire de Lune on the piano with her toes, like, I don't know, there were just a lot of running little elements like that that were just really kind of helped keep things together as, you know, we're jumping across the multiverse. Like, it was nice to have some running themes through there.
Yeah, and I'm just gonna have to jump back real quick and just, I know I'm not referencing what you just said, John, but not gonna let us call Ki Hu Kwan, who again, if I'm pronouncing his name wrong, the guy from Temple of Doom, because Goonies exists, all right? Goonies does exist, and he's a star of Goonies as well.
I have not seen Goonies. I was gonna say, yeah, there's like a story, the story of a girl reference earlier in the film, which I don't know why that was thrown in there, but when he's like, your hair never falls in quite the same way, like you always seem to run out of things to say. And I'm like, this is the, I love how they just dropped a lot of like tidbits in there. It seems like, I mean, just doing research on the movie, this is the movie they'd wanted to make for a while. I think they'd been working on this for like 7 or 8 years. So it seems like they dropped a lot of the jokes they had into it. They had the multiverse idea before the multiverse was everywhere. So they were a little hesitant apparently to release the film once like Rick and Morty started doing this. And then like Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse really kind of hopped on the multiverse train. So I think it kind of, they had to adjust a lot of the jokes they made because like Rick and Morty had stolen a lot of them. And then I'll note, if you enjoyed this movie, they also did Swiss Army Man, which I don't know if the two of you have seen, but it's super weird. It is Daniel Radcliffe, who plays this, you might have seen the like trailers a few years ago, but he plays this man who's literally just like a Swiss Army knife human who can like, I'm not even giving it justice. It's 100% worth a watch. Really good movie to watch, Stoned. What's the technical synopsis? I can't even find it. I don't want to ruin anything for you. It's definitely worth a watch. It was their first directorial debut. I think the only other film that Daniels have done outside of this one. So if you enjoyed this, I'd recommend Swiss Army Man.
Top of the watch list now.
It's on Hulu.
Oh, yeah. Might even throw it on tonight. Who knows? Maybe by the time this episode releases, I'll have already seen it. Who knows? All right, folks. We've been talking. We love this movie. I think it's finally time for our final thoughts and our ratings of Everything Everywhere All at Once. Kari, you've got some thoughts. We're going to pitch it to you first. You get to tell us what your final thoughts, lasting thoughts, and your rating out of 100 is of Everything Everywhere All at Once. Let's hear it.
Everything Everywhere All at Once. I know I used the term masterpiece earlier. To me, and I'm someone who sees a lot of movies, I don't often walk out of the theater like, wow, that movie was phenomenal. Most of the movies I see are bad, and most of the ones that are good are not that good. So to walk out of a movie having thought, having laughed, having, you know, teared up a little bit, as Jimmy V said in that speech, is a full day right there in one film. So to me, that was a masterpiece. And out of the movies I've seen the past 3 years, I've only had that feeling walking out of Uncut Gems and Parasite. So I think Everything Everywhere All at Once was phenomenally well done. And I know it's a pet peeve for Duncan and mine as well, that the majority of the movies you see in theaters these days are, you know, Doctor Strange this, or Thor 5, or Fast and Furious 15, or James Bond 24. And so to see a movie that is not only an original script, but also is able to tell a compelling story, to do so in a way that is both technically and narrative expertise, is just very difficult to accomplish. So shout out to the Daniels, Michelle, Jamie Lee Curtis, and the entirety of the cast. Great movie going experience. I give it 5 hot dog fingers out of 5 hot dog fingers. So that's about as high as I can go.
5 out of 5 is a great score. Can I get 1 out of 100?
I would go 92.5 hot dog fingers out of 100.
I love it.
I don't round up either. I'm one of those teachers, so that's an A minus.
Oh my gosh, he might as well have given you a 92.99 to the Daniels. He's like, all right, I'll give you everything but an A. All right, I like it. John, it's your turn. What are your final thoughts and your rating of Everything Everywhere All at Once?
Yeah, I mean, I'm still kind of processing. I've gotten two watches now, and I feel like I'm going to be rewatching this movie for the rest of my life. Like, it has so much staying power. And I think, you know, Kari mentioned this too, just all the little Easter eggs that he noticed on the second watch. Like, there was just so much thought put into this movie, and the whole narrative is so, you know, cohesive and connected. I thought it was so well done. And, you know, I started off this podcast talking about the human element, but I think beyond that, beyond like the core story, just the visuals were breathtaking, honestly. Like the way everything was, you know, edited together when they would first jump, or like the shots of, you know, Evelyn's face flipping through all the different universes, just so cool and so creative and imaginative what they did. And I mentioned, you know, the costumes and makeup earlier. Like, the one scene that comes to mind was when Joy was, you know, potentially going to jump into the Everything Bagel, how her clothes flipped like a bunch of times. And I don't know, it was just so cool and creative what they did. Every single detail in this movie was so well executed. So, I mean, I almost want to give it a near perfect score, but that seems crazy. I'm sure there's stuff, you know, that could have been done better. I'm going to say 98 googly eyes out of 100, but just enjoyed it so much. And I still don't even feel like I have a fully formed opinion on it yet going into this podcast. And I need to watch it 10 more times, but just such a refreshing movie experience. And like you both, I see a lot of movies and, you know, seeing an original story brought to the screen and something so ambitious, you know, a science fiction concept that's not even really well understood, to bring it to life visually and, you know, get us all to understand, you know, what they were going for, I think is such a challenge. So yeah, I just loved it. 98 out of 100.
Yeah, I should say that since we're mentioning that we're all big movie guys here, this is the New York section of GDT podcast. We got the New York squad right here for Sunday Movie Squad, and we're all, no free ads, but AMC Stubbs Premier List members. So we're all going to the movies. I'll tell you that much.
The heartbreak feels good
in a place like this. So I do love this movie. I had a lot of fun with it. I'm going to go a little bit lower than you guys. I do see some of the flaws in it, I think. Maybe in the same sense that Kari did. But I'm feeling more of a B plus than an A minus, I feel like. And again, listeners of this podcast know that my ratings are always a vibe, like how I feel about the movie. I can't tell you like where they lose the points. But for me, this movie was pretty much amazing. And it did a great job of being Matrix in 2022. It did a great job of being a action film that did new inventive things in 2022. Both hard things to do. It did a great job also of having a cast that knocked it out of the park, every single one of them. No one left me wanting more from their performance. So, a lot of things that I loved about this film. I've talked about it throughout the film. I love the inventive filmmaking that they did. I love the cinematography. I love the way they shot their fights. All of it, amazing. Just got me going. I left the theater both times with a huge grin on my face, just excited that I was watching a new film like this. And I have to get on my pedestal here right now, on my soapbox, and be like, watch films like this. When you see a movie out like this, go fucking see it. See it in theaters. When you see that Nick Cage has a movie out where Nick Cage is playing himself, go watch that. When you see that Robert Eggers has a new movie out where it's Vikings fucking going ham on each other, and he also got blockbuster budget, go see that movie. See these movies. Go back and watch The Lighthouse too, if you like Eggers. Dude, honestly, great stuff. Great stuff from everyone. A lot of great movies out right now for people who like new, creative movies. So I know this thought has been echoed on Twitter, but if you want to get out and you want to complain about every movie like I do and like Kari does, being a Marvel movie, being Thor 4, being Doctor Strange 2, being Spider-Man No Way fucking 5, yeah, you can complain about that if you go out and support these movies, right? If you don't, if you're going to sit at home for Everything All Everywhere All at Once, if you're going to sit at home for Unbreakable Weight of Massive Talent, if you're going to sit at home for The Northman, you got no leg to stand on. You don't get to complain that everything's Marvel because you're only going out for the Marvel stuff. That's you. You're the problem then. So that's my stance on that. Go see these movies. See Everything Everywhere All at Once. It's good. It's great.
Do we get a sequel? What do you think?
No, I hope not. I don't think so. I think the Daniels do something else afterwards. And here's what I got for you. I got 85 out of 100 dildo trophies. I think it's a great movie. And I think people coming out with a movie like this deserve to be supported. And I know, like, I'm going to get off my soapbox in a second, but seriously, like, if you want new creative movies, don't complain if you're not going to see this movie. If you're not going to see Nick Cage's new movie. If you're not going to see The Northman, then don't complain because they got them for you. They actually still exist. Even in 2022, they still exist. It's hard to find them because y'all are making it hard for them to make them even get made. I'm going to get off my soapbox right now, but there you go. 85 out of 100. I love this movie, and I want people to support movies like this. That's more of my soapbox. It's not even that I love this movie, because I do, and I'm going to recommend this movie to everyone, but go see this movie. Go see movies that are trying new things. You know what I mean? That's it. That's all I got.
Well said.
One final question. Raccoonie, what is his go-to dish?
You telling me a raccoon fried this rice?
At the end of the movie to impress the food guy.
I feel like you got to give me more time on this one. I don't have a clever answer. Is there a trash-related dish? Is there something that comes from the trash?
Probably some more you use your hands.
I was thinking tartare. That was my best guess was tartare.
Pixar, let's get it done. All right.
So we now have a special segment for the Sunday Movie Squad. Kari and John have taken a quick breather, but I am still here, and I am joined now by friend of the pod, Stevie P, to share his thoughts on Everything Everywhere All at Once. Stevie, thanks for being here.
Hey, what's up, guys? Hey, thanks for having me on.
Absolutely, dude. We're excited to hear your thoughts on this movie. I know that I don't want to spoil any of your thoughts, but I think that you have some stuff to say about it, right?
Yeah, I kind of told you about it. I'm a big fan, big fan of this movie. I saw it twice. Second time just as good as the first time I saw it. I love it.
Hell yeah, dude. That makes for a good discussion. And you'll be able to listen to our full thoughts between me, Kari, and John later on when this episode actually drops. But I can tell you that we weren't shitting on this movie at all. You know what I mean? We were saying good things about it.
So,
with that all being said, let's start this discussion real quick off with your broad thoughts. What are your like broad strokes on the movie, like as a whole, without getting like too specific about anything? What made you enjoy this film?
In general, I feel like it's been a while, or I don't even remember the last time I've seen a movie like this that made me, you know, die laughing and also bawl my eyes out and seeing something so creatively, not just, you know, visually, but the writing, everything is just, the direction is so creative and so different than all these, the movies I've seen. And it just stands out so much, which made me enjoy it so much. And it was consistent since the very beginning, the first shot until the end of the movie. And it's amazing. I love it. It's like a roller coaster and for like 2.5 hours. And then you just don't get tired of any of the loops, the drops. Like, it's just amazing all around.
Sweet. And I love that you're talking about not only that it's this unique movie, because we talked a little bit about that as well. And I totally agree with you that it's not a story that we've seen told before. It does have references to other movies, which we got into a little bit, but it's very unique, like you were saying, and it's got a little bit of, excuse the pun, everything.
Yeah.
Right? Like you were saying, it's got the comedy, it's got this mm-hmm. action, which it starts from the beginning. I don't know. I'd love to hear your thoughts on that opening fanny pack fight, because I think it grips you from the get-go, not only with story, with characters, with humor, with great acting, but also that first fight scene is important. And boy, do I think they land it, right?
Oh my God, absolutely. That whole sequence it's so absurd, but it's so good at the same time, which is, I feel like that just applies for the whole movie, honestly. Like there's so many moments that are so absurd, but it's so good. Like it doesn't feel forced. And like this dude is fucking like fighting with a fanny pack, man. And this is like a dad, like, we're good with spoilers? We're okay with spoilers?
Yes, you can spoil everything. We'll have a spoiler warning at the beginning of the episode, so no worries. If they're listening now, they can't complain. They've been
okay,
warned.
Okay, cool. All right. Because, like, a second before, he was, like, this loser husband, and, you know, he's sad, and he's, like, you know, he's kind of like a pussy, but then, like, a second later, he's, like, this badass, like, knows all these martial arts, and then he's like fighting with a fanny pack. It's so absurd, but the whole sequence is so well done, and I really like that everybody was so committed to it. Like it was executed perfectly. I loved it. What did you think about it?
Yeah, I mean, I talked about Matrix as well as Jackie Chan movies because I thought that like there's that classic clip, and I don't know what film it's actually from because I have a lot of blind spots in my movie viewing, but I do know there's one where like he's fighting with ladders, mm-hmm. Jackie Chan is, and it's very like, you know, using the things around you. And I think that's what he was kind of known for, as
yeah,
well as like, fighting
yeah.
with the mop, the broom that's around him. And so I got that from, you know, using your fanny pack. Like that's not a weapon. And
yeah.
using that to get the guns away from the actual weapons away from the people who are coming at you. And I don't think that anyone knew what I was talking about when I brought this up to Kari and John. I want to know if you know this shot, but the gun's on the ground and the camera is placed basically where the gun is, and someone tries to get it and it turns the gun and the camera turns with it. And just from the beginning, like that kind of camera work is very like inventive in the fight.
I remember like, was it like when he was like fighting to get the gun another security guard. They were fighting
yes.
to get the gun. Yeah,
yeah.
I know what you're talking about. Yeah. That whole sequence was amazing.
Yeah, and I love, like, that gets it going from the beginning, and I think it pretty much keeps the gas pedal going for action throughout it. Like, you're not disappointed, I don't think, throughout the movie when you're watching it, and at least I wasn't, when there's more fight scenes. It's not like they, you know, blew their load on the first
one. Right, right.
For example.
Yeah. I know exactly
I think it's
what you're talking
it's about. Throughout it, it's there. And I think that's true about everything. Like, we were saying, like, the humor, which I want to touch on in a second, and like the character elements and the acting throughout it as well, you know, top to bottom, everyone in it, we mentioned, just
amazing.
Phenomenal. And I don't think like the guy who played Waymond and the woman who played Joy, the husband and the daughter, I don't think they're getting enough credit because everyone's talking about Michelle Yeoh, who played Evelyn. And rightly so.
I feel like she, I completely agree with you because like, you know, I mean, everybody knows who she is, and like she's already a great actress, which is, you know, good for her. And to be fair, I think, you know, this is the first movie, at least I've seen as an Asian, I've seen almost all of her movies, at least like growing up. I do think, you know, this is the first movie that completely showed her whole range. Which she also said, like, in a lot of the movies promoting, a lot of interviews promoting for this movie. So, you know, but she's great. But I do agree that people don't give enough credit to her name, I think is Stephanie Liu, I think. The girl that played her daughter. And I know the husband, the actor that plays the husband was also in The Goonies, which I actually never seen a movie. But
Okay,
I think that's just an American thing. So that's like an American movie. So, you know, I didn't grow up here, so I didn't watch it. But I do need to watch it. But I know he played the Asian kid in The Goonies and in Indiana Jones.
Yeah. And yeah, we actually did. We brought that up because Kari mentioned it, and I was like, he mentioned Indiana Jones, and I was like, well, let's not forget the Goonies either, because he was obviously in both those. And it is cool to see someone who was famous as a child actor get then a career revival, it feels like, in the future.
Definitely.
Which it's, I mean, from his performance in this, he should have never stopped getting any prominent roles, in my opinion, at least.
Yeah.
But he's been, I think, out of the public eye for a lot of it. Like, I'm sure he's kept acting. I haven't looked at his entire filmography, but he's obviously not been leading role.
No, I actually was, like, watching this interview. He actually, like, he retired, well, semi-retired, and, like, did more of the behind-the-camera stuff, not because he, like, wanted to, but, like, film, when he worked on The Goonies and Indiana Jones, like, during that time, like, there weren't a lot of prominent Asian, like, roles for Asians. So after those movies, he didn't, there wasn't really any roles that he could get. So there weren't enough opportunities for him. Anyways, he, like, kind of didn't act as much anymore. And then when Crazy Rich Asian came out, he saw it and he, like, started missing it. So then he hit up his, like, another friend to represent for him. And then 2 weeks later, he got the call for this movie, which, crazy how all that, like, worked out. I was watching that interview. It's so crazy.
Yeah, that's fucking crazy. I love that. And, like, it's, I mean, we've touched on things like this in the past on the podcast, but, you know, the problems with representation in that, it is bullshit. Because, like we said, from this performance, it's proof right there that at no point should he have stopped being able to get roles. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. Like, he's obviously got the talent. Like, he's a great actor. Like, he has the talent, for sure.
Yeah. So, you know, it's bullshit that there weren't any opportunities for him and, you know, many others. Like, it's not it's not just him. Obviously, lots of people have suffered in their careers, have been, you know, hurt because of that, impacted because there's just not a lot of representation, or at least there wasn't. We're getting there, you know? We're getting better.
Yeah, for sure. Like, it's definitely, time is changing, and God bless, we're definitely doing much better than we are, like, 20, 30, 30 years ago. But I had notes for this because I want to talk about this, because the movie, going back to the movie itself, is centered around this Asian family, right? This Asian immigrant family. But another thing I loved about how well the characters worked is, and the whole story worked, is that nothing actually, you watch the entire movie, the narrative and the character is done so well, you never actually, there was no, like, political message, right? There's nothing stood out. You need to learn something about representation, about Asians, you know, conflict about Asian, growing up in Asian culture and American culture, which is, like, kind of what you see in Crazy Rich Asians. That's another movie by itself, another discussion. But what I'm trying to say, like, this movie, it just has Asians in it as the main cast. That's it. It's just a story. It's not an Asian story. It's just a story. And yet it's still doing so well. And I think that shows it's doing even better to fix the issue with representation, because it shows Hollywood and all the big movie studios that it doesn't matter. Like, you can put Asians in as a main cast, you will still make money. And I just read this article last night. This movie is already on track to be A24's third largest domestic box office selling movie. And so that's right below Uncut Gems, I think, is the first one. And then Lady Bird, which won the fucking Oscars, is their second largest. So they're about to be the third largest domestic earners for A24. And this fucking movie, the first like 2 weeks or something, they didn't even open to all the theaters. Like, you couldn't find a fucking theater to even fucking see it. Like, I had to fucking drive, like, 2 hours away to go find an AMC to see it. But, like, it's just fucking crazy. Like, so that's why, that alone is one of the biggest reasons that made me love the movie so much. Like, not just the stories, the characters, the actings, the cast, the people that made the movie. But the impact, like, I think is so important. This movie is going to make for the whole film culture, especially like in Hollywood.
I absolutely love that you brought that up and that you've brought all this to the discussion so far, because I think that we're getting exactly where we want to be in this discussion. Like, when we're on, you know, we love talking about the movie itself, obviously,
yeah,
and the stuff, the technical aspects of it, as well as the performances and stuff like that. But it's really interesting and important, I think, at times to talk about the representation of it all. And that goes for all the underrepresented communities as well, who, you know, it's go through stuff like this. And I think it's amazing what you were just saying about both stories are important. I think you need there to be some stories that are about, let's say, Asian Americans, for example,
for sure,
and that it's rooted, the story itself is rooted in their experience. That's important. That is true.
Yeah.
But you don't want every movie that has Asian Americans to, or Asians in general, I shouldn't say Asian Americans, but you know what I mean? Asian actors, anything like that.
Exactly.
You shouldn't be forcing that movie to then be about that. It should be like, okay, because every white person in a movie isn't talking about how they're white all the time, right? It's not it's not like they're not forced to be a representation of all white people, for example, either, which is a lot of times done to like minority groups as well, where it's like you have to be like portrayed as perfect, or your people say that you have to be portrayed as perfect, or else you're misrepresenting your, you know, your group of people, which is again bullshit. But it's really important for there to be roles that you can just get as an Asian person, that, and again, as all these underrepresented groups, that you can get, and it wasn't necessarily, it's not going to be, like you were saying, like in your face about it. It's not necessarily the story itself is about it, but it's a character who maybe could be white, could be Asian, could be something else, right? And that's important.
Yeah, exactly. Like, if you think about this whole movie, this family, okay, if you swap it out, let's say it's a Mexican family, it's a Mexican immigrant film, it will still work. The movie, the story, the characters will still work amazing. So it doesn't, like, just an example, but you swap out the family with any other race, it will still work great. And that's like the point I'm trying to make. Like, yes, we should actually tell Asian stories. That is absolutely necessary. And all the other underrepresented groups, their stories. But what this also did is it normalized that for all the other groups, they can tell stories in general. And Hollywood doesn't need to be afraid of doing that. They don't need to, because one of the main reasons 10, 20, 30 years ago, or even earlier than that, 40s, 50s, when there wasn't enough representations with African Americans. Why? Because the studios determined it's not, first of all, it's not needed. Second of all, they're a lesser class. And third of all, why would they put them on a feature film or a TV show? It's not going to make money. It's not important to have them. But then as time goes on, you realize, wait, actually, they're just people. They're just Americans like everybody else. They also watch TV. They also watch movies. They have their own stories to tell. And then they have the more representations, more stories. And then they realize, okay, this it is okay to tell their stories. And I think it's the same thing that we're seeing here for Asians, which God bless the progress that we made.
Yeah, and I want to get into a little bit of, I have a question about, we mentioned the humor of it, but while we're on this topic, I did want to mention one last thing, which is kind of going off exactly what you were just saying, that movies like this, when you were talking about it being the third highest grossing A24 domestically film, and movies like, you know, the one of the best and easiest examples to make is Black Panther, for example, for African Americans and that group of people, and that, and I guess, you know, just black people in general. You don't have to be American. That's kind of the point I want to make here. You don't have to be an American to enjoy these either. Because that's kind of the bigger idea, is that it's proof that no. People will buy the tickets and they'll connect to the stories as well, as long as you give them a shot. Right? Yeah. Like, they weren't buying any tickets to the movies because they weren't getting made in the past.
Exactly.
You know what I mean? They weren't given a shot. But I love that you touched on that, and I love that you brought those points here. I absolutely couldn't agree with you more, and I agree 100% on the idea of, like we were saying, the importance of there being both those kinds of stories.
Absolutely. And you think about, like, I know these are other movies, but like, you think about like the cultural impact Black Panther has made before it, the actual Black Panther movie even came out. When Black Panther, the character, only first came on in Civil War, like the kind of cultural impact already affected the whole America. And then Black Panther, the movie came out. It's a great movie. And then you think about the cultural impact. For think about like the little Black kids. They think when they originally, before Black Panther, they didn't get the same kind of representation on the big screen about this, like a Black hero. But now there's Black Panther. Now the little kids grow up. They don't need to be other superheroes. They have people's, like, superheroes like them. And then, like, I think about, like, Shang-Chi, it's the same. Like, it impacted a lot. Like, I look at my little cousins, and, like, they all love it. Because it's the same thing. Like, you get that kind of representation. That's something that you can bond so much over. Because you finally see something, someone that looks like you. And you can be a superhero like them, too. Like, it's so inspiring to, like, little kids. I don't know, but I know that's like another movie, but
no, I'm glad that you brought it up, and I'm glad that you brought up Shang-Chi as well. I think that's great that, like, I think those are great points, and the idea that there's now kids who can, in the past, didn't have the opportunity to, like, see themselves and now can, like, I don't know how that doesn't just, like, bring a little bit of a smile to your face, if anything. Right. Like, you could be, like, the biggest asshole in the world. I feel like that's got to brighten your day a little bit.
Exactly.
Speaking of bringing a smile to your face, you mentioned that the humor really worked for you in this film. And I wanted to ask you, because there's two big ones for me that are running gags that they really hit hard and they don't have any let up on it. Like, they're not, again, gas to the floor the entire time. And they don't kind of pull any punches with these jokes. And those are the raccoon-y and the hot dog fingers jokes. And I'd love to hear some other ones that maybe if you have anything else that you want to bring up as well. But did those must have actually worked for you, because I could see them, like, if those don't land, that could be rough. You know what I mean? And they did work for all of us, at least so far. But
no, like, I agree with all of you guys that, like, when you were first saying, like, the two guys, like, that was the first two I thought of. But I love, like, just like humor in general in this movie, like, it never felt forced, all right? It was, someone was fucking completely absurd, but they were, when doing these things, it still made you feel so emotional. Like, for example, specifically, like, another one that really worked on me was the first time they went into the universe when they were rocks. And it was completely silent, like, and the whole, everybody, it's hard to describe that feeling, because the first time it was, I never experienced something like that in the theater. I never experienced something like that watching the movie, because so they went into a universe where they were just rocks and they were communicating the way it was shown on the screen, which is text on the screen. And that's how they were communicating between the characters. That's how they were visually communicating to us, the audience. I've never seen something like that. And it was so funny because it was so absurd. But later on during, like, later when we returned back to that universe, when Joy was talking to Evelyn, you know, about their relationships and their generational trauma, blah, blah, blah. But they were doing that in this absurd scene when they were just two rocks. And they were just doing it throughout text on the screen. Yet, it still impacted us, the audience, so much. Because I remember specifically, the very first time we saw that scene when they were rocks, when they first went into that universe, you know, everybody was chuckling. You can't. Suddenly it turns into a silent scene. I could hear other people watching. They were chuckling. It was absurd. And then next time when we go back to that scene, it was an emotional scene. And like, I had to like try to blink my tears in, because it was such an emotional scene. And I think also it could because the first time I watched it with my mom. My mom came to visit me in LA. So I think it did hit me and my mom like extra hard. But it was, the thing is, it was the same thing with other audience too, though. Like it was a packed theater. Next time we go back to that scene, it was silent. Like everybody was fully invested in it. And I think the humor in this whole movie, it went in and out so perfectly. It was like a little dance. And it came and went at the perfect timing. I loved it. I loved it.
And that's kind of what you were saying from the beginning and where I made that silly joke, but it's true that it's got a little bit of everything in it.
Yeah.
And it does a good job of balancing it, which is really important, especially when you're going so heavily between different themes, like comedy that's so absurd, like you said, and then really touching moments. So you kind of just touched on it a little bit, but what do you think about the overall, because obviously like you said, it's not got an agenda in the sense of
exactly
like beating you over the head with it being like, for example, an Asian story or anything like that. It's not like doing anything like that. It's a story for itself, but it's got its own quote unquote agenda, which is parents and their kids and dealing with that. Right. And it's not like, again, I said quote unquote, cause it's not a real agenda. It's just what the movie's about. Like movies have to have themes or else you're not watching something really, you know, I don't know what that looks like exactly if you don't have an overall theme of your movie.
Like the overall theme and the plot. I see what you're saying.
Like, right. Yeah. So like, what did you think of that and like Joy's motivation in the film and then Evelyn's reconciliation with that at the end as well?
First of all, there are certain nuances between like their relationship, how they interact in general, just because the main cast is Asian. So there were just certain things like I could relate like since the very, very beginning, especially from how Joy interacts with Evelyn and like that kind of relationship is just the way how they interact is so common between like Asian families, like their parents and their kids. That's like so similar how I talked to my parents. But anyways, it was also the first time I think I ever see a movie like this that talks about generational trauma in that way and how, and really visually represented how this kind of hurt and pain came coming from an earlier generation and how it could be passed down to the younger generation to be a story to be told that way. I think it's really impactful to the audience for sure. What did you think about it? Because I want to see it from your perspective, how you could relate. Like, would you be able to relate to that?
Yeah. And I think it's, again, goes to what you were saying earlier, where it's saying that it's proof that you're creating a story that can impact other people. It doesn't have to be about the specific people that are in it. Like you can see maybe more similarities to your own life potentially. And yeah, I understand that for sure. And like same thing, like we were saying, I'm gonna keep coming back to it, but like Black Panther, if you're a black kid or an adult as well, you know, it doesn't have to be a kid, but if you're someone who can relate on that level to it, you're gonna get a little bit more out of it. But it being a good movie, Black Panther, I'm talking about right this second, I connected with it. And I know plenty of people who aren't black that connected with it as well.
Right,
and
exactly.
I think that's the same here where it's like, it's doing a really good job of, there are aspects of it that are Asian or that are specifically Chinese, I guess.
Yeah. Well, one of the Daniels is Chinese, I think, or like, because the Daniels that made the movie, there's Daniel Kwan and then Daniel, I forgot his last name, but he's white, but Daniel Kwan, like he's Chinese. So that's why like the like all the Asian elements I feel like in this movie is done so well, but the Daniels don't actually only do like movies like this. Like this is only their second feature, but I think their last one was Swiss Army, whatever the fuck.
I think Swiss Army Man is it called?
Swiss Army Man, yeah, the one with Daniel Radcliffe, which is amazing, by the way. For like a feature debut, that's fucking nuts. Because I remember I saw that movie 3 times too, twice in theater, and it was really, really good. It was like the same thing, like visually, it's creative, the story is creative, the character is creative. I feel like this movie, which is that, even though it's like a completely different premise and like, you know, characters, but just like on steroids, it was like, if someone watches movie now, Everything Every All at Once, right after you go see Swiss Army Man, it would be like, Okay. This all makes a lot of sense. Okay. I see like where all this is coming from, how it all comes together. Also, one thing I wanted to mention is that visually it's filmed so well. I gotta give credit to Larkin Siepel, I think is his name. It's the cinematographer for the movie. He actually has a great resume. He worked on the This Is America music video, the one with Childish Gambino. He also worked on great music video. And lead for this, that boxing movie with Miles Taylor. He had a great resume. So we'll talk about this later, but like visually, it's this whole movie is so crazy. And I've never seen like characters or even like simple little things to be presented this way, or like the different camera work. I don't know. It's very refreshing for sure.
Yeah, I totally agree. And like I said, I think that you'll get more out of it maybe. And someone who has the same background will get more out of it. I actually didn't know that I think his name is Daniel Scheinert. I didn't know that he was, you said he's white?
Yeah, I think he's white.
Yeah, I wasn't aware of that. That's interesting that they were able to have, because I do think that, and you'd be a better judge of this, obviously, but I do think that it's handled very delicately and like well, mm-hmm. right? Yeah. And I think that it's interesting that it's coming from not a cohesive background when you like they don't both come from the same place. And I think it's interesting to even maybe that's a benefit. And like I don't know why it wouldn't be a benefit to have more diverse backgrounds in general when you're making a movie. But it is interesting that this team themselves were able to make something that's balancing both an Asian story and just a good story together. It's like, well, is that you know, helped by the fact that they have, and I'm sure that you know, one of them could do it on their own potentially. Like, I'm not saying that like neither of them could make a movie by themselves, but I think it's interesting to look at them as a team. And I love directorial and writing teams in general. Like, you know, you want to talk about the Coen brothers or Lee Winnell and James Wan for Saw. I love things like that. I think it's very interesting when they stick together.
Yeah. The Russo brothers, there's like a bunch of them. Like, yeah. I do feel like, it's the movies, like when it's not just a single director writer, like when it's like a duo or something, like a trio, like it's like the dynamic is very different. Like I feel like, you know, you get more collaboration, so like the ideas kind of, you know, flow better. I don't know, it just feels different.
They say a big reason why the original Star Wars trilogy worked so well, and the reason that technically speaking, maybe on a storytelling platform, the prequels didn't as much, was that on the original trilogy, there was more cooks for George to be like told no to and stuff like that. And then on the prequels, he was kind of given complete creative control. And like, there's definitely certain instances where having like one auteur or one person that's helming the entire thing is better. Like, I think Stanley Kubrick on our last interview, Alex Lorien mentioned that Stanley Kubrick has a quote where he kind of talks about how one person creates, I think it's artwork or something, like a painting. So one person should create a movie as well, which is not necessarily always the right way to do it, obviously. But I think that it's important to know that there are certain people who I think benefit from being more in control and having their own like one person vision. And then there's duos like we just mentioned, and you know, we talked about A24 Uncut Gems before. The Safdie Bros are a good example of another one of those. But it's just an interesting note to touch on. You were mentioning the visuals earlier, and I'd love to hear some final thoughts on your just overall, like, because I think we talked about how inventive it is, how unique it is. And I think a lot of that is the visuals. And I love that kind of stuff. That's what makes it, in some aspects, what we like to call in this podcast, a Duncan movie. Multiverses, for example, will get you going. That's the Duncan movie for example. Yeah. But then like good endings and really intense visuals that are kind of unique and inventive are really important to me. So I think that, you know, you kind of touched on those. Is there like broad things you want to talk about, like with the visuals and stuff, or any like specific things as well? Because this would be the time to like bring up like a more specific, like if there was a scene that really grabbed you or anything like that.
I remember like specifically the first thing that I think one of the first scenes that like kind of just left an impression in my mind when the first time I saw it was when Joy or
Joe Buzapaki, I think.
Yeah, Joe Buzapaki,
I could be saying it wrong. Yeah, yeah. It's along those lines.
Yeah, I really know how to pronounce it, but like yeah. that her when she showed when the first time why she made the everything bagel. It was so funny, but also visually it was beautiful, but it was a fucking bagel, and that was just so absurd. It was just so funny, and it's like, go back to the same thing, it was like emotional too, like it was because the reason she made it, she wanted her mom to see like the kind of pain and the kind of experience that she sees for experiencing all these different universes, because her mom is pushing her to, you know, pushing her limit, her mind to travel to all these different universes. But now this is all she sees. This is all she experienced. So she puts it on a fucking bagel. So it's just so absurd. But visually, I remember visually, it was just that, how they show that whole bagel black hole type of ordeal. It was beautiful. Secondly, there was the first time we saw the rock scene. I thought that was beautiful. And there was so many different scenes. Oh, the dude, when Joy first got switched to the JoJo, the back character, when they did the head thing, and then dude, that shit was so dope, dude. I don't want to hear what you think. What were some scenes that suck out to you? Because there's so many.
I agree. It's literally like so many things. And I think a lot of it is in, I don't know how to pronounce her name, but the woman who plays Joy's performance as well. Like yeah. You said, that head tilt. And then, like, it's from the beginning, the nails changing when she's dragging them across cubicles. I love that. And then her movements, like we mentioned it earlier, like when she goes like and like limbos underneath the police tape and to go in, like it's very like nonchalant and everything, and that's more of like a performance than it is, I guess, a visual there. But I have to agree with like the everything bagel aspect of it. I agree. And then you talked about how that's both comedic and balancing like the emotional aspects as well. I think that, you know, some of the fight scenes are hysterical, like when she's turning things into dildos and stuff like that. You know, but it's also a sick fucking fight, you know.
Dude,
what I mean,
it
it's
so
well
sick.
Choreographed. It's like, and the balance of that, I love it all. I love those kind of visuals.
Oh my gosh.
I do think the first half probably has the better visuals and the second half gets more story
oriented. Yeah, for sure.
But anytime they're doing those things where it's like, have you seen the video for, what is it? Is it Gives You Hell? It's one of the All American Reject songs.
Uh-huh.
Where it's like the guy standing there and he just keeps changing outfits because they just they keep like filtering through it. It's very much the same effect here where it's like they go from different universe and they just, you know, cut really quick from each one, and it's like almost like it looks like it's blending together.
Yeah.
Love those visuals when it's like showing all, because you know how much time that probably took to film all those different versions of her too, and you're showing like a millisecond of each one. It's crazy. So I love that kind of stuff.
Yeah. I remember that, like, they did that for, they had a scene for, I think they had a Servo scene like that with Evelyn. Like, they just showed, like, up here and then, like, different universes. It was, like, when he's, like, jumping through different worlds. That was fucking dope.
Yeah, I love that kind of stuff. Like, playing with the multiverse of it all is really, I think, a good way to go. And I think they were unique and inventive. Again, I know I've used those two words over and over again, but I think they did a really good job of being those things. In the way they filmed it, in the way they told the story, and again, the visuals. Like, I love the visuals. And you got to, if you're going to do a topic like this, if you're going to go that crazy, you got to kind of push some boundaries as well. And they did.
Yeah, for sure.
So going off that, we've touched on a lot of the stuff. We've touched on the performances, the visuals, the comedy, the balance of it, the representation, and the fact that it's not only good representation, but it's a good story for anyone to be telling. And it just so happens to be an Asian American story or an Asian immigrant story. But we've touched on all that. We've touched on all that. And I know that we're getting close to the end of the runtime here. So I want to ask you, do you have any final broad thoughts before we get into our final thoughts? So this is not your rating yet, but if you want to touch on any things like a scene that you still want to touch on, just bring it up now, because This will be the last chance we have.
I was going to say earlier when you said, like, you see the most, like, all these different visuals in the first half or, like, first act of the movie. I do feel like the first act, right away, like, it grabs your attention. It kind of, like, what I was trying to say with the roller coaster, like, it puts you in a seat. You put on the seatbelt, like, tighten it right away. And then from there, you just go through all these different, these different rides. But the first act, it just straps you in. It gets you ready. It grabs your attention. It kind of gives you an idea of, like, a playbook of, okay, you kind of get an idea of how this movie, what is really like, what the characters are really like, what it visually kind of guides you, what you're going to be expecting. And then you kind of just along for the ride, like the best ride you're going to have in the movie theater. I think that is amazing.
Hell yeah. And that's actually something that we did bring up. I forget if it was Kari or John who brought it up originally, but they were like, I think it was Kari. They were like, you are in from the beginning. And we all agreed on it, where it's like, they hit you from the beginning, they don't waste any time, and they get the action going, they get the inciting incident going, and they keep, like you were saying, it's very much a roller coaster. They have you enthralled from the beginning, and like with visuals, with performances, with storytelling, with all of that, I think they don't let up, and they start very soon in the movie, which is good.
Yeah, which is amazing. Also, like, even though like the first act, they did like all these crazy visuals, you know, they had like, you know, crazy, you know, characters when they were doing all these stuff during this part of the story. I feel like when they transitioned into second act and like towards the end of the movie, like the pacing was never fucked up. It just went like naturally. It just went perfectly up until the very end, like all the emotional like climax, all these like characters finally coming together, Evelyn confronting all these like her relationship, you know, with her husband, her dad, her daughter. All of this, like the pacing just went naturally. You're just going through all this motion, this development with the character. It never felt out of place. It never felt, you know, it unnatural. And I remember like the first act, the first half, you kind of, you feel excited, you know, you get a little bit, the whole movie, you get a little bit of everything. You get action, you get comedy, you get a little rom-com vibe, you get horror in the beginning when they first introduce the villain and the, you know, the tax lady, you know, you get a little bit of everything. And then you also get the drama, sorry, on the second half of the movie. And I remember both times after I see the movie, as soon as the last scene ended, the credits come up, everybody sat there. Like they are waiting for a post credit scene. It wasn't presented as, it's not marketed as like this superhero movie, like a Marvel movie. Like, I don't think people were expecting a post credit scene, but like, I think people just were just processing what they just saw. Like, cause it was so different than what they've seen or maybe what they've expected at all from going to the theater to see that movie. And I think there has been like definitely several, a few movies I remember that have an audience reaction like that. And I feel like that is so inspiring because that is the kind of movie that we should be making. The audience shouldn't want to walk out of the theater right after the last scene, or right as soon as the credits, as soon as it ended, even though the credits come up, let them sit there, process what they just saw. You let them think about it. And I think that's those movies are so, so impactful.
Wow, I couldn't agree more. I love everything you brought here. I love your points. I think that's a perfect way to talk about it because I think that my audience did the same thing. And like you were saying, they weren't necessarily looking for a post-credit scene. They were just processing it. And that's what you want. Like you said, I think it's amazing. So with all that being said, it is time now for you to give your final thoughts and your rating, put your money where your mouth is, of this film. What did you really think of Everything Everywhere All at Once?
I thought this movie was everything. I thought it was amazing. Everything I could ever wish for in the movie and the experience in the theater, I rated 100 Hotel Fingers out of 100.
Oh, yeah. We've had now, I think that might be our second or third 100 ever. Maybe
really?
Third. Yeah. We've had a couple, and I always love it. I love when someone wants to talk about a movie that they really are. Like I said, put your money where your mouth is. You did. 100. You're like, look, it doesn't get any better than this.
Yeah. I genuinely feel that passionate about it. Like yeah. How I connected with it.
I fucking love that, man. I love that. I'm so, I mean, it came through in the discussion. I really do. I got to thank you so much for taking the time to join us today.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, man. Like I said, the discussion was phenomenal. And I think that our listeners can really learn a lot from the whole episode, hopefully today. But I think this last segment was a lot of fun and really kind of thought provoking a little bit.
Yeah.
And something that I think, again, that not only will you, is it just entertaining for the listeners, but I think they can maybe learn something too.
Mm-hmm. For sure. You said this episode comes out in a few hours?
This episode, we are releasing this on Sunday, May 1st. We are recording this right now, a couple hours before the episode's going to release. So yeah, I got to get my editing hat on, and then we will be off to the races.
I will definitely make sure I listen to it tomorrow. Thank you so much.
Thanks for joining us. There you have it, folks. That is Sunday Movie Squad, episode number 1 in the books. Did we just do it? We just did it. Absolutely. Stay tuned for June for our next episode. I don't know what day in June it will be, but it will be the first Sunday in June that you get Sunday Movie Squad next. I know it's a long time to wait, but folks, you're going to be able to do it because we have 3 episodes a week coming out. That's right, we have Monday miniseries episodes coming out. That's on Nostalgia, Memories of Tomorrow, my short film coming out with Kari, the director of my short film. It's gonna be great. You're gonna want to hear it. You want to learn about it. We're gonna have other people on it too. We're gonna have some actors on future episodes. We're gonna have the guy who made the score coming on for future episodes. We have that. We have Wednesday bonus episodes that also sometimes come out on Thursdays if we have a reason for that. Like, let's say when Moon Knight wraps next week, we're going to have that episode dropping on Thursday because those episodes release on Wednesday. So we only have so much time to get it back to you. So we're going to watch the finale of Moon Knight on Wednesday with y'all, and then we're going to record it that night and release it for you the following day. Then we also have our full episode next week, which releases on Friday, and that will be an interview with the cast of Dreams of Paper and Ink. Our audience will remember Dreams of Paper and Ink from our interviews with Glenn Triggs, a favorite recurring guest of the podcast, who has talked about his movies on the pod before and has talked about his upcoming film in 2022, Dreams of Paper and Ink, which we are very excited to learn more about. So next Friday, we have an episode with the cast of that movie, which we can't wait to share with y'all. But in the meantime, don't forget to stay up to date with us by subscribing to us on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or anywhere you listen to podcasts. Remember, we are available everywhere. And additionally, you can also follow us on Twitter and Instagram at GoodDataPod and on Facebook at GDT Podcast. And for everything else, stay tuned and listen to our back catalog of movies. Thanks for listening to this episode. We will talk to you again tomorrow on Monday.
Jenny Slate's character, only named Big Nose. Should Everything Everywhere All at Once be canceled? We'll talk about it next time.
For GDT, it's JDT. See you next month.